It's a pleasure to be back with you today, as Bob reminds us for the fifth time. That's amazing. And we bring you greetings from your friends in Napa. We have just recently changed our name. For a long time, we've been known as the UU Fellowship of North Bay, and we weren't quite sure that was best, since we now have our own building and so on, that would best identify us. But there was considerable controversy. Some people didn't like the word church, and some people didn't like the word fellowship. So what are we going to do? So the decision was eventually made to use neither of those terms. So we are now officially, well, maybe not officially yet, but we will be in the next few months, the Napa Valley Unitarian Universalists, period. So come and visit us anytime. Please forgive me if I begin with a personal reflection. I grew up in a very small town in western Pennsylvania. I mean a very, very small town. The total population was just under 300. That was on a good day. I went to high school in another town, not much bigger, 4 miles away. And to give you some idea of its size, I'll tell you that there were 26 in my high school graduating class. The year after I graduated, there were only 13 seniors, so after that, the school merged into a larger district. I suspect some of you have had similar experiences. Geographically, then, my world was very small. Almost twice a year, we would travel about 70 miles to Pittsburgh to visit an aunt. And until I was over 20 years old, that was the largest city I'd ever been in. In those days before interstate highways and relatively cheap air transportation, long-distance travel was restricted to those who had enough time and money to go by train. But in spite of the rather limited world in which I actually lived, at a pretty early age, I became aware of a much larger world that was out there. And that from two sources. First of all, my grade school years were during and immediately after World War II. So I heard radio broadcasts and read newspaper reports not only from Washington and New York City, but also from and about London and Rome and Berlin and Moscow and Cairo and Hong Kong and Tokyo. All cities which I have been privileged to visit during the 70 years since I first heard of them. My one grade school room did not have a lot of resources, but one of the best ones for me was a large globe, and I used to spend a lot of time looking at it and spinning it around, never dreaming at the time that I would one day have opportunity to travel around the earth which it represented. The second source of my awareness of the larger world was in the church and Sunday school I attended. As you might guess, they were also very small, and not much given to more than the usual Bible lessons, though from them I also became aware of another time and place thousands of miles and years away. But there were also occasional references to missionaries, people who would go to darkest Africa, as it was called in those benighted days, or the jungles of South America, or to the heathen of China. And while, as I will shortly suggest, I think the missionary movement is now obsolescent, no longer appropriate, I shall always be grateful that it taught me to be conscious and concerned about a much larger world than was immediately available in my daily life. Now, I'm not alone in having had such experiences. A few years ago, the Roper Organization polled adult Americans to see what they dream about. Number one on the list, you can probably guess, was being rich. But the second most popular response was traveling around the world. Now, by American definitions, I have become only moderately rich, though it is important to point out that I am, and so are most of you, p- possessed of such wealth as the vast majority of people on this planet can hardly dream of. In any event, I have been rich enough to have realized literally the second dream of traveling around the world. Now, I report all this not just to brag nor to lay another nostalgia trip on you. Rather, I suggest that my experience has not been untypical. Largely because of technological developments in communication and transportation, one of the major factors of our lives has been the enlargement of our world, the world, that is, of which we are aware and can have some knowledge. When you stop and think about it, you can only marvel. 100 years ago, there was no radio, no television, no air travel, no long-distance telephone. But now, I can pick up the phone, punch a few numbers, and in a matter of seconds be talking with friends in Western Australia. Or I can get on my computer and in a matter of minutes be seeing real-time images from there. Or if I really want to, I can get on a jet plane and in a matter of hours be walking down the streets of Perth. Again, it is not just me. You can do it also. The wonders of technology and the increasingly complex interactions of world economy have made all of us aware, in ways our great-grandfathers could not possibly have imagined, of the whole world, which, thanks to satellite pictures, we have for the first time in history been able literally to see as a whole. It is not just a possibility, but a necessity for us to think globally. Now, I've not told you anything that you don't already know. You know how our lives can be affected by things that happen all over the world. Currency fluctuations in London have a ripple effect on the whole world's economy. What Bashar Assad or Putin do is making all of us nervous. All of you know this very well. But what I want to suggest is that this growth in our world awareness has been a very good thing, a positive development for the human race, even a valuable phenomenon spiritually. To be sure, it has been accompanied with much pain and suffering. Many of us became aware of the larger world because wars in our time came to involve the whole world. In fact, once one wag has suggested that God created war so that Americans would learn geography. Conflicts among world powers have caused thousands of deaths. People all over the world know what is happening everywhere. So when a Pakistani national is convicted of a crime in the United States, some of his Pakistani supporters may choose to seek revenge by randomly killing some Americans who just happened to be in Pakistan. Nevertheless, in the long run, I want to insist it is good for us humans to know more of the whole world. It is better that we are conscious of all humanity and not just of our own families and neighborhoods. To know more is to be more. For that is why we are here. That is the purpose of human life on this planet, to know and to grow, to become more than we are, to evolve into beings who are no longer restricted or limited to mere time and place, but who can increasingly identify with the whole of humanity and all its joys and concerns, its pain and suffering, its possibilities and opportunities. It is that vision which inspired the teachings of Jesus and the Buddha, of Confucius and Moses, of the Hindu and the Taoist. And it is surely that vision which may and should continue to motivate a church that it aspires in its very name to be a universalist reality. The United States of America and we who have been citizens of this nation have been singularly blessed. And that is, it seems to me, an incontrovertible fact, not just the rhetoric of a 4th of July speech. We have had available to us abundant natural resources, a temperate climate, and a favorable geographic position. To the north of us are relatively few people who have nearly always been very neighborly. To the south, peoples whom we have always been able to dominate, though sometimes through arrogantly violent means. And to the east and west, we have thousands of miles of ocean, which means that for much of our history, we did not have to be much concerned with what was going on in the rest of the world. We were isolated, and we liked that. George Washington, in his farewell address, told us to avoid foreign entanglements. And then there are still among us political isolationists who will quote those words. But as a result of our historical isolation, we developed the presumption to the point that we now just automatically presume it, that American ways are the best ways. On the NPR program, All Things Considered, some time ago, there was a long report on the subject of child care in America. With reference to the dilemmas in which various families find themselves and the ways various communities and government agencies are trying to cope with that problem. But nowhere in an otherwise excellent report was there any mention of how Europeans, for example, have dealt with the same situation and have been dealing with it for many decades. It was almost as though child care is a uniquely American concern. We are not used to thinking that we might be able to learn something from other cultures. If it isn't made in the USA, what good is it? Well, I hope I'm not offending too many of you, and even if I should offend all of you, I will say that any way that such an attitude of America first, last, and only is woefully inadequate. Actually, technological and economic facts in our day are such that you have to go pretty far to find a politician who would preach the isolationist gospel that was very popular in the 1920s and which even lay behind the McCarthy Square of the 1950s. Vestiges of those earlier eras still live on, too commonly expressed fear of foreigners and in the paranoid fantasies of those who apparently sincerely believe that a worldwide conspiracy exists to eliminate the United States of America. My only fear, on the other hand, is that that elimination will not occur soon enough. Far-seeing thinkers have long recognized that the nation state as it presently exists and has existed for about 300 years is obsolete and probably the source of more trouble in the world than it's worth. You just have to look at the Sudan and Israel and various other places in the world today to see vivid examples of stupid bloodshed caused by fervent nationalisms. Though, by the way, I suspect there's no such thing as an intelligent bloodshed. The age of empire is over and should be. Imperialism is dead and should be. Earlier, I expressed my appreciation to the Christian missionary movement, which gave to many of us a lively sense of other peoples and cultures. But the day of missionaries is also past, because we now recognize that it simply will not do for one nation or religion or culture or ideology or political system even to attempt to convince, coerce, or convert. No one nation or religion or culture or ideology or political system contains the whole truth, nor is any of them the answer to all the problems which various human beings on this planet must deal with. To understand this, by the way, is to understand at least one aspect of the current crisis, so-called crisis, over Iranian reluctance to scale back their nuclear program. From the Iranian point of view, why can't we have nuclear devices? Although they do not, they claim they will not make the nuclear devices, they want to develop nuclear capabilities for other uses. From the Iranian point of view, shared not incidentally by very many other Middle East peoples and others, the United States has called the shots on the world scene for much too long. The very fact that the United Nations is headquartered in New York City is evident enough to many people that nothing happens in the UN without American approval or consent. All I'm trying to say is that we Americans have to get over the presumption that if it is American, it must be right. The world in which we live extends far beyond our shores. Our consciousness of that fact and our attitudes about it must catch up with the technological and economic realities of our age. Being aware of the big, wide, wonderful world in which we live is important because it will give us needed perspective. When you know the world, the whole world, you discover that things were not always the same as they are now. Did you know, for example, that 1,000 years ago, the greatest, richest, most culturally advanced city in the whole world was Baghdad? At a time when our European ancestors were still struggling out of the centuries-old Dark Ages, when civilization in Europe was at a very low point indeed, Baghdad was the capital of an Islamic empire stretching from Spain to India. And in philosophy, science, education, culture, and the arts was more advanced than any other place on the planet. When Baghdad was sacked by the Mongols in the year 1258, it is said that the Tigris River ran black for 3 days from the ink of all the books that had been thrown into it by the invaders. There is little question that the 20th century ended as the American century, a time in which American culture had, for better and for worse, captured the world. But 100 years from now, the story is likely to be very different. But this perspective that comes from being aware of the larger world works on the personal level as well. Buddhist literature tells the story of Kisa Gotami, a young woman whose small son had died and who consequently was so stricken with grief as to be inconsolable. She went to the Buddha to see if he could do or say anything to relieve her intense distress. He told her to go into the nearby village and obtain 7 grains of mustard seed. That seemed simple enough, she thought. There was a condition, however, said the Buddha, and that was that she should get the seeds only from a house which had never known bereavement or loss. When Kisa Gotami went from house to house, people were quite willing to give her the mustard seeds, but when she asked whether there had ever been a death in that house, she quickly discovered that every house in the village had had that experience. Thus, her own grief was assuaged by the realization that she was not alone, that others also had known the pain of suffering and loss. It is a lesson that transcends time and place. It is the lesson of all the various support groups that have evolved in our individualistic age, as people have to learn all over again that their problems are not unique, that others have been where they thought only they had gone, and in that discovery, they find consolation and hope, not only to endure, but to face the challenges of life with courage and optimism. Many years ago, I read this short poem, which I've never forgotten. I had no shoes, and I complained until I met a man who had no feet. This is a church. We are not here just to hear political statements, which I've made this morning, or psychological help, which I've also attempted. We are here fundamentally to go deeper than that. We are interested in what the New Testament calls growth in the Spirit. And that is why it seems to me it is so very important for us ever to enlarge our vision of the world. Spiritual growth means going deeper, not being satisfied with the superficial. But it also means growing wider, not being satisfied with the narrow. It has to mean that, because the ultimate goal of the spiritual life is experience of the infinite, the unlimited. A spiritual life which focused only on the puny individual self would be a contradiction. To grow up means to grow out. So let us seek and enjoy every opportunity we have to know that big, wide, wonderful world we live in, both spiritually and literally.